what of a grip on this, a handle on this, it can make such a difference. Such a difference. So, but I think you kind of know that intuitively and know it even more. A couple of things. Two things. People have asked me about my different books, which do I like the best, which is... Oh, and they also ask... the people were recording some of the demo sessions, and that's not okay. You need to erase that, because those are, they're only recorded when we get a written permission from somebody. So please, please delete. Otherwise, you know, this winds up somehow on social media or something like this. I mean, even by accident, and it's a violation. It really is a violation. So I'm going to need to do something about that. Finding a therapist. If you go to the trauma healing website, there are you can find therapists in most areas. I mean, SE is being taught now in 42 countries. So, and there's a lot of people in the Marin, San Francisco, East Bay area, really good therapists. So if you go to traumahealing.org, you can find that. You also list trainings that are in different areas. And I just noticed there was a table out there with some pamphlets about when the next trainings are going to be. So you can find those. Okay, getting back to which book is my favorite. Okay, right. That's a question you ask a parent. Which kid do you like the most? Well, it was me until my brother was born. I can answer that question. They're very different. They're all very different. Waking the Tiger, which is astonishes me that it's still in print, because it was went into print in 96, and I wrote it starting around 1991, 92. And that was sort of the... I guess you could say it's the book that kind of put me a little bit on the map, because there were really was only one book on trauma at that time, and that's Judith Herman's book Trauma and Recovery, which is still an absolute classic. I do tend to disagree with her about that everything has to be healed in relationship. That's part of it. That's half of it, maybe, but it's not the whole thing. But really, her treatment of torture and violence is so important. I definitely recommend it. Anyhow, so that book is really, it's not trauma for, what do they call it, dummies? It's not that, but it's kind of filling in what was unknown at that time, which was a lot. And it's an easy read, at least that's what people say. Then I wrote a number of books after that, and I did a book CD called Healing Trauma, Restoring, a Pioneering Program for Restoring the Wisdom of Your Body, something like that, that sounds true. And that also, it really looks at also at this in a spiritual way, and different exercises one can do to help work with trauma. It's some of the kinds of things you've been starting to do here, but it's in guided voice, guided imagery. It's a little small book. Then I wrote a couple of books for children. One is called both with Maggie Klein, a superb SE teacher, and she was a school psychologist, worked with a lot of violence in schools. And it's called Trauma Through a Child's Eyes, and it's a big book, and it's got a lot of specific stuff, like for school violence and surgical trauma with children. And then with the idea at that time was to make a thin book for parents, but it didn't work out that way. You know, sometimes you get started graphophilia and you don't stop. So then we said, okay, well, let's make a book just for parents and people who, like coaches and people who have contact with kids, grandparents. And so we made this much shorter book, and it's in red, and it's kind of about this size. And the idea behind it was, Mao Zedong, he wanted everybody in the kingdom to have a red book. So that was sort of the idea, but it's somewhat of a different message. And it really is about not only how parents can help prevent trauma developing in their kids, but how they can build confidence, joy, and resilience. That's the title, Trauma Proofing Your Kids, A Parent's Guide for Instilling Confidence, Joy, and Resilience. Okay. So, and everybody really, if you have kids or grandkids, or you know somebody who has kids, or you want a child yourself, it's a great read. And then, and there were a few in between. Then after that, I wrote my main piece, which is In an Unspoken Voice, How the Body Releases Trauma and Restores Goodness. And now I think that was written in 2010. And it's got a lot of stuff. And it also has a chapter on CYBAM, on how you work with those inner states. So it can also be recommended. And then finally, in 2014, with Laura Riegel-Budo's help, actually in more than one of the books, we wrote a book called Trauma and Memory, Brain and Body in the Search for the Living Past. And it's, of course, how the past lives within us, but of the different types of memory and how to differentiate them, how to work differentially with those different types of memory. We've been alluding to a lot of this stuff when we talked about procedural memories. Unfortunately, as I say, the computer connection isn't working right now, but that's, again, fine. But a lot of things we've done on body memories, procedural memories, how to work with them and how to differentiate them, and how, not just in trauma, but in many instances, I can give you an example. I think that's in the book. I was visiting my parents back a few decades ago in New York, and so I was museum hopping, and I was coming back, you know, around 5 o'clock, and the trains are, you know, packed. The subway is packed, and there was almost everybody there was a man in a suit, gray or dark suit, with a newspaper rolled up under their arms. And out of the whole, I mean, again, it was packed like sardines, out of the whole train, there was one person who, I couldn't understand it, but as I looked at him, I felt a certain warmth in my belly and a little lift in my chest. And, you know, why this man in this whole car? So it turns out, he got off at the last stop, which was 205th Street in the Bronx, and he got out, and I came up by his side, and I touched his arm, and the words came out of my lips, Arnold. So we both looked at each other, kind of perplexed. And then that was what I remember, that when I was in the first grade, elementary school. I came in late in the, for some reason, because of my birthday, late in the semester. I guess you don't call them semesters, but anyhow, late in the school year, I was the smallest kid in the class, and the ears that I have right now, which are good for holding these microphones, but they were probably about the same size then as they are now, so I was a lot, you know, bullied, and kids would call me Dumbo, and you know, but there was one kid in the class who befriended me, and that was Arnold. So where is that memory coming from? Well, it's coming from way back then, but it's there in an implicit form, So, so these are the promptings that we get, and that we're able then to move it into what are called episodic memories or autobiographical memories. So after that encounter, I was walking up the street back to my parents' apartment, and I had these drifting of images, in the CYBAM, And one particular image of a twin that were one of the worst bullies. And at one time, they forced me out into Gun Hill Road, into traffic. And I felt in my body this strong urge, again, a procedural memory. So I went from a procedural to an episodic, back to a procedural. And I could feel my arms wanting to flail outwards. And then the image came clearly that what happened is, as they forced me out, I just started swinging wildly. I scared the shit out of them. And they scattered, and that was the last time I was bullied. So this whole thing connected with Arnold. So you see how these things interweave. There's a really great diagram of how these memory systems interweave, but again, you'll have to buy the book to see them. Oh, okay. So we'll get some kind of the presentation that'll get emailed to you if you want. Obviously, a lot the video stuff and some of the photographs and so forth are copyright protected, or I've bought in copyrights too, so I can't do that, obviously. So, and also, I will be glad to sign a few books here if you want, right at the end. And for now, I guess it's time, because you probably have an effluge, an accumulation of questions. So I'll take some questions. Whoop. The first, number one, two, over there, way out in left field. Okay, and then there's one here, and then one here, and one here, and one here. So waving hands, so. There are a bunch. Oh, okay, she's ready to go. You got, give her the microphone. Go, 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 go.
Thank you so much. This is very, very rich. I want to get back to, maybe it's spoken in your book about trauma and memory, but I want to talk a little bit more about, if you can, about the collective trauma.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Especially coming from ancestral type of ways in which looking. And, you know, I'm wondering if you've done any work on how traumas occur through ancestral lines vis-a-vis violence, death, other horrors.
Sure.
That may have happened in at least in for my particular thinking right now, heritage, you
yes.
know, over 300 years ago.
That's right.
And where these particular traumas still lay within the cellular memory, your description of PTSD, I know, I'm sure you've heard of Dr. Joy DeGruy and PTSS.
I have, yes.
How do those interweave, and can you speak to how those traumas are really laid within
yes.
our systems?
Yeah. I mean, we do a disservice to deny them, to not say, oh, that happened in the past. That's over. That should be over. When all of these memories are playing through in the present, the living past, but not just the past in our historical, but the generational, informational information that's passed on. And, of course, in our country, a big part of ancestral trauma for black people have been slavery. And anybody who thinks that slavery is over is something that happened. Well, first of all, I mean, I was in the 60s, and there still was, you know, I mean, there's still Jim Crow, even at that time. And again, we're talking about, again, the effect of this over time, when families were separated, when people were treated like products. This is something that not only affects black people, but it affects us all, because our ancestors, not us, but our ancestors in some way participated in that. And again, this is not a blame game. It's not a blame situation. It's understanding this reality that actually can give us some freedom and healing from these generational effects. You know, I worked with at the Hopi Guidance Center in Second Mesa, Kirosmimi, Arizona, for a few years. And the legacy there was incredible. It was a genocide, and then the kids were made to go to Bureau of Indian Affairs, BIA schools. Their mouth was washed out with soap. If they ever learned the language, if they ever used the Hopi language, is it any surprise that the young people don't want to learn the Hopi language? You know, so, I mean, everywhere you look, really, you know, those with Irish background, I mean, we're also talking about the potato famine, how that affects us. Everybody is affected. There's one thing I had wanted to do, and just never has materialized, is to do a special group with people who have these different ancestral legacies and work together in a group, in a supportive group, to work with these and to be able to cut some of these cords of the generational trauma. So, again, to answer your question as briefly as I can, this is something that we absolutely need to recognize as a society, really. Yeah.
And even in the recognition, how does it, I mean, I don't know the science of this, but I just know that it exists because it exists within me.
Sure.
That there can be triggers that come up that are unknown to me. And is that, because it's from a traumatic memory that I haven't, that has happened in my legacy, in my ancestry.
That's right.
Is that the science of that?
You know, yes. And another way of looking at this, I'm not saying this is science, but that we all carry our own mythology. And I don't mean that it's completely in a positive sense. We all got here, those of the traumatized, we all got here through a journey, a heroic journey. And that's true for every living being, every sentient being. So that's not scientific, but it's for real. But again, the scientific, remember when I talked about the passing on from generation to generation of just even that specificity of a particular smell. So obviously these things are passed on, and they're not attenuated through generations until we are able to break that cycle. When how I came to this, when I was developing SE in the 70s, I would eat my favorite restaurant was on San Pablo Avenue in Berkeley. It's called A Beggar's Banquet. I don't think it's been around for many, many, many decades. But anyhow, I just loved to be there. And I would sit at a table. A lot of times I was alone. So I would sit at a table for two. And all of a sudden, somebody sits down in the table facing me, and I look to see who it is, you know. And they said, "Can I sit here?" I said, "Certainly." And I realize it's Albert Einstein. Where's that coming from? Right. My thoughts, I actually found out where it was coming from, but let me hold out on that for a moment. So anyhow, I spoke with him many, many, many hours. And sometimes I would order, I mean, because he was real to me, a couple of soups, and then the waitress would say, don't you want to finish one first and then have the second one? I said, no, actually I'm expecting somebody. Well, the person I was expecting was already there. And so we would have these conversations. And one time I talked to him about what my observations of generational trauma at the time. And I asked if he had any understanding of this, how this can be in a time-space continuum thing. So he nodded benignly, and he took me to this pond, and he took a yardstick, a meter stick, and on the stick were a whole bunch of pebbles, small stones. So he took me to the edge of the pond, and then the stones were balanced on the ruler, and he twisted it, and all of the pebbles came down at about the same time. And the wave went, you know, you can imagine each wave intersecting each other, going on for infinity. And he said, that's the flow between generations. And then he said, but what happens is something gets stuck there. He called them an ego point. But I said, Albert, respectively, I would call those a trauma point. Would you agree with that? He said, well, you have to tell me more about trauma, but it sounds about right. So what happens then is everything after that is distorted outward. So so anyhow, the trick, he said, was to find two or three of these points and to unstick them however you could, and then the wave fronts would then go back into harmony, into flow. So that was my basic inkling of understanding. You have to find a place and they have to unstick it. Right? And that guided me. So I just happened to be, I was visiting my parents, and I mentioned that. And my mother, probably today would have been considered a psychic. Not the best mother in the world, but she had some real profound gifts. And I mentioned that. And she looked at me and she said, oh, I know exactly why that is. And I said, really? And she said, when we were pregnant with you, we're about 8 months pregnant, and my parents were in a canoe, and they were canoeing in this lake, and a wind squall came over and tipped over the canoe, and they were both unable to right the canoe and get back on, and the storm was coming up. In that moment, a small sailboat, like a dinghy sailboat, came by, and there was a young woman and an older man in the sailboat, and they saved my parents' lives and my life. Well, it turned out that the people in the sailboat were Albert Einstein and his daughter. So there was the connection, again, through the fetal. So. And listen, there's more than we can know and understand, but these mysteries continue to happen.
Go for it. So I also work with women with eating disorders, primarily women with bulimia and binge eating disorders.
Yes.
And I notice they have two things in common. One is most of them have significant trauma histories, ACEs score,
sure,
7, 8, 9, and all of them are very disconnected from their bodies.
Yeah.
And I also had an eating disorder, and I was very disconnected from my body. And one of the biggest barriers that I come into in my work is, I think culturally we've been trained that we have to talk about things ad nauseum and analyze things,
sure,
and pick things apart. So when I encourage them to sort of focus on their body sensations, there's this distrust of where is this leading, where is this going?
Mm-hmm.
So when you're working with resistant patients, how do you sort of enroll them in this idea that focusing on your body is the very thing that's going to have them break?
Well, I don't try to enlist them. But I give them some explanations, almost the same explanations that I gave to you today. Really about why it's important to be able to work with sensations and to get new experiences in our bodies. And, you know, I consult with the Meadows in Wickenburg. And whenever I'm there, I also spend a day with the adolescent, young adult eating disorder kids, and they love this. At first, they are, I wouldn't say resistant, they don't know quite what to make of it and quite what to make of me. And then as we talk, it really starts to make sense, and we even do some of these kinds of simple exercises, and things shift. Because until that shifts, I mean, of course, this can be life-threatening. So a lot of the treatment is medical. But if you don't deal with the, quote, psychological traumatic, it's going to be temporary. Same with any addiction as well. So basically, that's what I do.
Well, I guess I do a psychoeducation piece and then some exercises. I think what's been challenging is, well, it's sort of the twofold, the sort of expectation of having to dig through everything, and then also the sort of fantasy that's been sold of, like, the quick fix. And so when neither of those things are present, then it's...
Right. Well, it's a slog. I mean, it is. I mean, eating disorders are extremely complicated. They begin in very early, and they are reinforced by a pathogenic society. Actually, one of the books that's in press that Laura and I are working on is something like Real Sex for Adolescents, because of the disconnection that is so prevalent in our society. I had some slides about that, but we won't be able to do that. But it's really so... People are so disconnected from their experience and so disconnected from each other. And the only education they get, it's not like this in Europe, the only education they get really is pornography from the internet. And so it's a disembodying environment, and it develops in pathological behaviors. You know, and again, with eating disorders, it's to look thin, to look like the models that are on the TV. So it comes in all directions. It's reinforced in the society. You know, it looks like we are coming here to the finale. So I'm going to, because the audio part is working, so I'm going to play that, and let's just kind of go out on that. And then I will do again some signing if you wish. Okay, signing of books, I mean, not sign language signing. Although I'm fascinated with sign language. So let's just go inside here.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. And in my hour of darkness, she is standing right in front of me, words of wisdom, let it be, 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 whisper words of wisdom, let it be. And when the broken-hearted people living in the world agree, there will be an answer, let it be. But though they may be parted, there is still a chance that they will see. There will be an answer, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be. Yeah, there will be an answer, let it be. Let it be,
Okay. Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you, really. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.